speeds than light does, giving the wonderful blue glow you might be familiar with. That is Cherenkov radiation. Lynx jumped back in, knowing he was going to lose his audience if he didn't intervene. And, sir, that may be connected to another mystery. In the anti-submarine group, we've been focusing on the Directorate offensive at Pearl Harbor and then out at sea. But the attack, of course, began in space. And when you speak with our DIA colleagues about that, they'll tell you that one target didn't make sense, a particular NASA research satellite. We assumed that the Directorate had gotten their intel wrong and thought it was a clandestine spy satellite. That's why Dr. Shaw's here. Doctor, could you tell the Admiral what your project at NASA focused on?
It was originally designed to collect Cherenkov radiation for research into the origin of black holes. But because NASA wanted to show Congress tangible results, Shaw put that phrase in air quotes, as if to show his disdain for applied research. It was also used to study nuclear power plants and the real and potential dispersion of radiation after events like the Fukushima and Maine Yankee incidents. Darling cut in. So, sir, I ran down the old Pentagon budget funding for R&D programs and found that back in the 20th century, the Office of Naval Research did some studies that showed that tracking a reactor via the Cherenkov radiation it emitted was theoretically possible. But the subject was never really explored. It wasn't just that the project had a low likelihood of success. It was that even if it worked, there wouldn't be much of a payoff for us. Our entire subfleet was nuclear, while the Russian and Chinese subs that were the most problematic for us were the quiet diesel-driven ones. There were no incentives for investing in that kind of research. ONR assumed that no one other than us was advanced enough to do it, and strategists worried that if we made the effort, well, the research might get out, and we would just be doing the other side a favor. Lynx jumped back in. We have to conclude that they made a breakthrough and discovered how to track the Cherenkov radiation, which allowed them to de-stealth and target our submarines, as well as anything else powered by a nuclear reactor. And that solves both mysteries, the attacks at sea and the targeting of Dr. Shaw's satellite. Because if you and the other side both had that ability, you would want to make sure the other guys lost it. You'd take it away from them, even if they hadn't known they'd had it in the first place. The Admiral didn't respond for a full 10 seconds, but his jaw clenched, and a single bead of sweat formed at his temple. Then his words poured out in the quick cadence of someone who cannot quite believe what he is saying, and so wants to get it out as fast as possible.
This theory sounds like an improbable mix of drunken gossip and answers looking for questions, which means it's probably correct, and if it is, we have a very, very serious problem.
Kaena Point State Park Beach, North Shore, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. Major Conan Doyle aimed for the break in the reef, navigating the stand-up paddleboard out through the mellow swell. The Boeing D-TAC microcomputer strapped to her forearm vibrated, indicating she was close to the rendezvous point. She'd been wearing the standard-issue black plastic device the morning of the invasion, part of the emergency kit used to communicate securely with downed pilots. 3 days after the convoy raid, it had suddenly pulsed with an incoming message. A quick scan of the stars overhead, the shore behind her, and the jet-black ocean farther out showed nothing. Had she incorrectly decoded the message? She dropped to her stomach and used the paddle to hold the board against the current, feeling a sharp hunger pang as she lay prone. She should have taken a blue before she left, but she wanted to conserve them. The microcomputer had directed her to this location. Earlier, Hicks had revealed that the group had it at 4-to-1 odds that it was a trap.
That's why God gave us grenades, Conan replied. And so, here she was, exposed.
The real reason you want to go, Nix had said, is so you can wash your clothes.
That was true. She'd paddled out barefoot, but kept on the pants she'd worn for 2 months straight. A twitch beneath the surface caught her attention. Something had moved. Something big. The innate animal sense of being near something bigger and more powerful chilled her immediately and blocked out her hunger pangs. It was like pounding a handful of stims. Doing that wasn't her style, though.
Everybody was different. Some people needed stims when they entered the breach. Others needed focus. Beta blockers worked best for her, as she was naturally keyed up enough. She held herself steady on the board, fighting to keep her legs from shaking. Another dark glimmer beneath the surface, a faint eddy whirled in front of her. Even if she'd had a gun, she couldn't have shot it. Directorate sensor balloons would vector a patrol to the area, and she'd be on the rack within an hour as Chinese and Russian interrogators cut her open and pumped her full of drugs. Combat medics had their golden hour to save a life. The directorate interrogators had their golden hour to exploit it, or so she'd heard. It would be better to die here, alone in the jaws of a giant, than be rent into pieces, physically and mentally, by the opposition. The water stirred maybe 20 feet from the board's nose as the dark form closed in. This was it, then. Doyle got to her knees and changed her grip on the paddle. Now she wielded it like a sword. The irony, she thought, that Conan had no real blade when she needed it most. A dark fin sliced the water's surface. She raised the paddle over her head. At least, she thought, her last act as a Marine would be a violent one. She brought the paddle down with all her might, just as the wave glider's tube-like hull broke the surface of the water. The paddle bounced off the hard black plastic, and Doyle fell off her board and into the sea. She found herself swimming alongside the manta ray-shaped drone, running her hands over it to convince herself it was not a shark. These nearly undetectable vehicles used almost no electricity. They relied on the ocean wave's energy, rather than traditional engines, to drive them forward. Doyle's DTAC buzzed again to indicate that the wave glider had established a network connection with the microcomputer. A faint green message reported it had downloaded a series of files, and then another message told her what to do. To open the cargo hatch, she first had to pull off a collection of trash hung on the vessel's foils. The drone must have transmitted through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Inside the vessel's hold were two waterproof duffel bags. The way their camouflage pattern shifted to match the rippling ocean surface, and then the paddleboard's deck, made it clear something important must be inside. Presidium Boardroom, Directorate Headquarters, Shanghai. When Vice Admiral Wang Xiaoqian stepped through the holographic globe onto the raised podium in the center of the room, all conversation stopped. There was no longer a need for his old classmate to introduce him. Most of the audience he had never met in person, but they all knew Admiral Wang's face from the viz updates. The newscasters called him the new Sun Tzu, the architect of the new victory who had been inspired by the wisdom of old. He knew it was not a true assessment of his place in history, merely a creation of the Information Ministry's algorithms and driven by what tested best with the public. It was pleasing all the same, and more important, it created a new responsibility to be seen and heard. That was the reason for holding the briefing in Shanghai, rather than Hainan, to ensure the civilian leaders felt involved. The room was sleeker, more stylish than the military's command center. It also held a much larger group. Assembled today were dozens more than usual. The Corps Presidium membership had brought their aides and cronies. This was a triumphant moment, after all, one to be shared widely. As Wang took his position at the front of the room, a large holographic banner fluttered behind him. The United Kingdom's new red and white flag flapping in a non-existent wind, the blue of Scotland having disappeared after the second independence referendum in the wake of the attack.
Just one. In Europe, only one ally stands with the Americans. The no longer great Great Britain, said Admiral Wang.
NATO's disillusion had been a long time coming, but the alliance's sudden unraveling by a simple diplomatic vote was almost as big a shock to Washington as the directorate's surprise attack had been.
And they have what to offer their Yankee allies? The very same F-35 fighter jets whose electronics we know well, and a carrier jointly owned with the French. Paris refuses to allow to go beyond the Atlantic.
The flag receded into the corner of another flag.
In the Pacific, who stands with the United States? Asked Admiral Wang. Again, just one. Australia.
Wong eyed the audience. Most seemed attentive, a sign of their respect, and it was almost time for them to put on their viz glasses.
How recently did they believe that our need for their minerals was a vice clamped around our balls? What good are they now? You are more skilled in business than I, he said, knowing it was important to show deference to this audience. But even a mere sailor like myself can understand that their entire economy is based on something that they can no longer sell without our consent. The blockade remains unbroken, and our mineral reserves are more than adequate. Soon enough, they will beg us to take what they once threatened to withhold,
Wong added, paraphrasing Sun Tzu. To subdue an enemy without fighting is the acme of skill. The last flag appeared, the American flag. He stepped forward, and the flag shrunk behind him, the symbolism not lost on the audience.
Please put on your glasses, said Admiral Wong.
He donned a matte black carbon and titanium mesh pair of Prada Viz glasses, a Shanghai-only limited edition model that his mistress had bought for him soon after the invasion of Hawaii. They were too flashy for his taste, but he knew they would go over well with this crowd. The Viz feed took them through the flag and into a sweeping tour of images collected from both intelligence sources and open source feed. A line of F-35 fighter jets sat abandoned at Kadena Airfield, the base now back under Japanese control as part of the neutrality deal. Then, a line of American families waiting at a food relief center in Indianapolis, all of them eyeing the neon orange boxes on the other side of a taped blue line. The next image was the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, where lawmakers from the 2nd Congressional District of West Virginia and the 6th Congressional District of Washington flailed at each other with liver-spotted fists. That was followed by a bed of wilting roses laid around the hooves of the famous bull sculpture on Wall Street, a gloomy reminder of the rash of trader suicides that had followed the stock market's collapse.
These images show the new reality the Americans are learning to live with. In time, they will see the advantage of their fate.
The audience was then flung high into orbit, alongside the Tiangong 3 space station. A collective gasp of awe followed, predictably. They gazed down at the Pacific, and then there was another wave of gasps as they began to freefall through the atmosphere, dropping all the way down to Pearl Harbor. Slowly, the audience took in a panoramic view of the harbor from the perspective of the second deck of a Chinese warship moored there, which allowed them both to catch their breath and see the at-ease sailors, who looked like they belonged there as much as at any home port in China. The Presidium members and their guests burst into applause at the journey, and where it had ended, in evident victory.
But the beginning of wisdom is to call things what they truly are. That was a magnificent tour of our achievement to date. Yet we must understand this. We are at a stasis point, not a completion point. We are no longer fighting battles, but the war is hardly over, Wong said. America's conventional forces cannot reach Hawaii, let alone attack us here. But those facts don't stop the Americans from harboring such ambitions.
The scenes then flashed quickly. A company of American Marines in desert camouflage, a mix of shame and anger on their faces, as they trudged down the stairway of one of the civilian passenger jets the United States had been forced to lease from Brazil in order to extricate its troops stranded in the Middle East. Next was a warship in San Francisco Bay, covered with a ramshackle assortment of tarps and scaffolding, clearly undergoing some kind of refit. Then, a time-lapse satellite image of a Connecticut shipyard making painfully slow progress constructing a single submarine. Then, the sad face of a little girl as her father helped her place her pink tablet computer, decorated with ribbon, inside a handmade victory box at her school. The tablet would be taken apart for its microchips, which were no longer available from China.
The combination of our opening strikes and your actions on the economic side since have been devastating, said Admiral Wong. But we must remain alert. I told you months back that we had no choice, and now they have no choice. Their dignity drives them to believe they must try once more. And this strike, they prepare is one we should welcome, not fear. Only after it fails will they accept the new turn in history, theirs and ours. My reverence for Sun Tzu is well known, and so I will close with a quote that shows the journey yet to come. To secure ourselves against defeat lies in our own hands, but the opportunity of defeating the enemy is provided by the enemy himself.
The viz feed ended, and Admiral Wong removed his glasses. He felt a hand patting his shoulder in congratulations, and turned to see Wu Han, the economics minister, who would be making the next presentation.
Sterling!
Wu had built his fortune through Macau's gaming industry. During the transition, he had been a crucial source of intelligence, and thus leverage against the old Communist Party bosses and their cronies, many of whom had been indebted to Wu in some financial or personal way. Wu's presentation lacked dancing girls, but little else when it came to showmanship. The music built steadily as he discussed how the directorate was beginning to gain more favorable trading concessions from countries in Latin America and Europe. It reached a crescendo as he announced that preparations to extract natural gas from the Mariana Trench site were ahead of schedule, while Mexican and Venezuelan oil imports were already increasing. The economics minister largely steered clear of Admiral Wong's purview until he reached the topic of the Panama Canal. It still remained a sore point between the two sides of the directorate. Shutting down the Americans' ability to swing forces easily between the oceans had been a necessary part of the attack plan, drawn from analyses Wong had commissioned about mistakes Japan had made during the previous World War. The Americans' only other route through Cape Horn was thousands of miles beyond their air cover, and being dealt with through a mix of submarine picket lines and a debt swap for basing deal with Argentina. But to the business side of the Presidium, the elegant military solution was viewed as an investment lost. The compromise the two sides had worked out was that the canal repair costs would be included in the reparation demands that the Brazilians would pass on to the Americans. Wong nodded, as if in empathy with Wu's lament, but then switched from watching the presentation to catching up on his real job, running a war. A short viz report his aide had sent him showed the christening of a new Liang 4 type-guided missile destroyer, but also noted a decrease in crew preparedness. Next up was the information minister, a young technocrat who had made his fortune in the software industry. He kept his blue-tinted viz glasses on the entire time and looked timidly at the floor while he spoke.
Our Weibo microblog analysis reveals positive feedback from the public is 7% greater than the most optimistic models predicted, he said. We have the kind of support that will allow us to continue without worrying about any unexpected expressions of disharmony.
Admiral Wong's face showed intent interest, but his focus remained on his work as he scanned on the viz through the latest intelligence reports on American ship movements.
Optimism about the economic future is high, again reinforcing the stability and harmony necessary for enduring growth, the information minister concluded.
Still staring at the floor, he mumbled his verdict.
The people are with us because we are winning.
No, they are with us because they feel that the war is over,
General Wei, commander of China's land forces, interjected.
And it is. The Americans are...
He paused, looked over to Wong, and said,
defeated.
It was a veiled attack on Wong, all the more notable for taking place in front of the Presidium's civilian members. The prior meeting of its military members at Hainan Island had been contentious as the officers argued over whether to consolidate their gains or follow Wong's proposal and press their advantage against the Americans in order to provoke one last action before they were truly ready. The question was whether the general's retort in front of the civilians was personal, due to jealousy over the plaudits that Admiral Wong had received, or institutional, part of the army's ongoing play for power. Wong quickly made eye contact with his aide to alert him that what he was about to say might cause trouble for them both.
Of course, I agree with General Wei that we are all swimming in success.
A gentle reminder that the victory had been determined at sea, not by Wei's land forces.
But I must disagree
with his word choice. Defeated implies that this war is over. One cannot make a foe accept defeat, even when they have lost everything all at once. Remember that, said Admiral Wang. Our ultimate victory is to build upon their acceptance of defeat. They are not there yet, and that understanding is not likely to be reached through a peaceful process.
What can they do to fight us? Asked Wu, the economics minister. Their economy and its military-industrial complex is so dependent on manufacturers elsewhere for spare parts that it cannot help but grind to a halt.
Projections show the next 3 to 6 months should see its complete collapse. That is defeat in my eyes, added General Wei.
We can hope so, Wang countered, but history shows that great powers have trouble accepting their own decline. They tend to go down in a very messy manner.
They wouldn't dare to mount an offensive at this point, said General Wei. Will they christen ships just to see them sink? Fly aircraft only to see them shot down? They now know that we control the heavens and can track their every move.
Let them try, said the information minister, still addressing his shoes. New battle footage would be most helpful for our approval ratings, as well as the combined harmony index. Quite a bump.
Do you not see? They are now in a situation we were once in, facing a foe who operates with unfettered success to the air, space, and sea, but who could watch and deny their every move, said Admiral Wang. But that does not mean they are a defeated nation. Our next steps will require guiding them to this realization.
He explained his proposed strategy to block the United States maritime trade. This included targeting the Atlantic routes of supply, where the Directorate had not yet deployed its Stonefish missiles, for fear of triggering a conflict with Europe.
Our goal should not be more fighting for fighting's sake, but fighting to provoke the right response, a final sortie by the remnants of the American fleet that will allow the war to be ended on our terms. And yet, then, we must give the Americans a means to save face when defeat is to be accepted. As Master Sun advised, we must build our foes a golden bridge to escape across.
The economics minister responded, Admiral, the question of what to do with the Hawaii zone is as simple as it would be on any card table. You do not just return to your foes what they have lost. They must give you a proper exchange for it. Both our energy security needs and the honor of the nation deserve that. And indeed, even if you are right, and the Americans do make another attempt before they accept they have lost, this is for the best. You do not want someone to flee the table. You want him to remain and play the game, hand after hand, until his wallet is empty and his will is gone.
The meeting continued in circles like this. At 80 minutes in, Wang's aide came over to him as planned. The admiral rose without a word, feigning disappointment that duty was now taking him away from the other's company. His aide remained in his place, recording with his viz glasses and ready to reach Admiral Wang if needed. In the bright, sunlit hallway, packed with assistants and aides, Admiral Wang heard someone call him. It was the Russian liaison officer to the Directorate's military planning group. Admiral Wang struggled to remember his name, wishing he were still wearing his glasses.
Admiral, my congratulations, said the officer in fluent Mandarin. His dress uniform was well-worn but immaculate. I know you are a busy man. I only wanted to say, as one warrior to another, that how you conducted yourself in there was impressive. I'm not sure I could have been as restrained.
Wang weighed the remark. He judged the faded blue eyes, set wide apart beneath a forehead bisected by a faint scar. The tone of his voice was conspiratorial, in the manner of one professional addressing another.
I don't envy you having to engage with civilians like that while you also have a war to win, the Russian officer continued, clearly enjoying his own voice. It is, though, of course, the price of the compromise your directorate has made, to be led by both those in uniforms and those in business suits. In Russia, it is much simpler. Whatever our dear leader says goes.
Indeed, your leader still has the killer instinct, said Admiral Wang.
So do you, Admiral, so do you.
Wang nodded his thanks, but the officer continued on.
More important, you told them an essential truth I must agree with you on. The Americans cannot be counted out. Ever.
Major General Sergei Sechin smiled. Sandy Beach Park, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. Lieutenant Feng Frank Wu stopped in the warm, waist-deep water and froze. He'd lost her. Then she reappeared 10 meters ahead. A minute ago, she was wearing a black bikini top. Now, she was topless, beckoning him farther out. It was all the motivation he needed, despite this being only his second time on a surfboard. He had enjoyed many privileges as a son of a member of the Directorate's Presidium, but surfing was not one of them. Though he had gotten his degree at UCLA before the war, he hadn't wanted to have reports reach his father that instead of studying mechanical engineering, he was spending his time as a beach bum. No, he had always done his duty, even now, in this show of shared patriotism, where all the Presidium's second sons had joined the military. Not the heirs, of course. His older brother stayed safely back in Macau. But no one said duty didn't have to come with deserved rewards. There were better things to do than pore over casino ledgers. And learning to surf with a beautiful topless girl was one of them. Frank paddled eagerly, arms crashing down into the water, which kept making the board shoot out in front of him. Strength didn't matter in the water. He was sure he heard a giggle over the rush of the surf, and then he caught a glimpse of flesh as she dove again. The surf breaking on the reef was getting louder, yet the water was shallow here. He could stand up if he needed to. Besides, Directorate sailors weren't supposed to be afraid of the ocean, or beautiful girls. "I'm one of the good guys," he wanted to explain to her. She emerged just beyond his reach, her naked chest gleaming in the moonlight. Then she dove again, the flash of white revealing she was no longer wearing her bikini bottom either. He nearly fell off the board when Carrie reappeared at his side, treading water and flashing an enormous smile. It must be deeper here, just outside where the waves were breaking. At least it was calm. She climbed up on the board and sat behind him, her body so close he could feel her nipples press into his back.
"We're nearly at the break," she said. "You have to feel it, it's magic."
She explained how she wanted him to paddle into the wave. If a wave was about to break on him, she explained, he should just duck under the water and wait for it to pass. You just had to be patient.
"Be brave," she said. "That shouldn't be so hard for a soldier like you."
He was a sailor, but before he could correct her, she dove under again. He pressed his body into the board, arched his back, and paddled smoothly now. As he paddled, he realized the waves were much bigger than they had looked from shore. In an instant, a wave lifted the board upward and toward the beach, then dumped him into the surf. He tried to get up by kicking off the bottom with his feet, but he couldn't reach the bottom here. He surfaced, blinked salt water from his eyes, and reached out for the board. But another wave washed over him. Where was she? He closed his eyes as another wave started to break over him. With a big breath of air, he ducked under the water, just like she had said to do. Then he felt a soft touch on his cheek, the board's leash flickering about underwater. He brushed it aside, but then it became taut, pulling around his neck. He grabbed the cord, but the hand trying to push it away was gradually drawn closer to his throat. His other hand reached out, but the current kept turning him around. He kicked, trying to reach the water's surface, trying to breathe, swim, and fight all at the same time. The harder he fought, the tighter the leash squeezed as wave after wave broke over him. JFK, Citigroup Airport, Queens, New York City.
"You want a letter of what?"
Admiral Byer didn't like having to leave the Pentagon in the middle of a war, and he definitely did not like having to sit inside a 787-9 executive jet that had been done up like the Studio 54 nightclub from the 1970s.
"A letter of marque, Admiral. My lawyers told me I need one," said Eric Cavendish. He added sotto voce, I would have assumed a sailor would understand this from his naval history, but I guess not.
Admiral Byer dug his fingernails into the seat's brown velour. Sitting beside him, the President's Deputy Chief of Staff, Susan Ford, watched the Admiral, ready to intervene if he took the bait. Fortunately, Byer didn't react. He'd read the intelligence profile and was prepared for a great deal of nonsense. Sir Eric K. Cavendish had been born Arcus Kumar to a middle-class family in the suburbs of Melbourne. Trained as a geneticist, he had made his first billion from several key patents in cell regeneration and cholesterol blockers. But Kumar soon figured out his talents lay in organizing other scientists to make money, and he'd ridden the biotech boom to the ranking of 7th richest man in the world, notably the only billionaire among the world's top 25 who did not live in China, Russia, or the Middle East. And when the world economy tanked, he scooped up everything from the business holdings to the private islands of the overextended billionaires farther down the list. Whether it was changing his name to something more royal, or buying Manchester United and forcing the team's manager to put its new owner in as goalkeeper in a match against Leeds, the billionaire seemed to follow whatever whim he woke up with in the morning, and apparently, Byer thought, his latest whim was to waste an admiral's time.
Let me put it in your American terms, then, since trying to meet on common naval ground was apparently unwise on my part. I want a hunting license, said Cavendish. He made a pistol with his right hand and pointed it upward, miming shooting at the lime-green shag-carpeted ceiling. For up there.
Byer sat back heavily in his seat and began softly tapping his fingers. If Cavendish had known Morse code, he would have recoiled at the insults the Admiral was hurling at him.
Sir Eric, please tell us exactly what you have in mind, Ford said.
Cavendish closed his eyes as if collecting his thoughts. In fact, he had collected them carefully over the past several days. The idea might have started as a whim, but Sir Eric had thoroughly investigated and vetted it. He knew that it was feasible, though it would seem outlandish.
The United States military predicament is evident, Cavendish said. Your air power projection is limited, especially given that you no longer trust your own warplanes. The land forces are now mostly in the retail and border security business, guarding stores from looting, and the border from people who no longer want to cross it is, I suppose, the best way to keep the country on its feet, said Cavendish. Your Navy's primary mission, given that it cannot sail past what the Chinese have aptly labeled a demilitarized zone, demilitarized for you, not them, of course, is corrosion avoidance. That is also a battle you will lose, I am sorry to say.
Byer looked at Ford and began to stand.
I don't have time for this bullshit. I need to get back to the building, said Byer.
Ford responded by putting her hand on Byer's. Sir Eric, you are wasting the Admiral's patience and now mine. And when you waste my time, you waste the time of the President of the United States, she said.
Please, I apologize, said Sir Eric. I grew too excited. Allow me to pause the conversation a moment and reset.
A traditionally dressed English butler came in and wordlessly offered each a flute of champagne. There was no way Byer was going to drink with this man, but he couldn't find anywhere to set the glass down other than the shag carpet, where it would tip over. Cavendish's flute was half empty when Byer looked back up. Good. Maybe the arrogant bastard was nervous after all.
Admiral, please, you must try it. I bought it just for you, said Cavendish. It is one of the last 1907 shipwrecked Eidsieks. This bottle was on a freighter that was sunk by a U-boat in the First World War, and sat on the bottom of the Baltic for the next century, perfectly preserved in the icy waters.
You were saying? Ford prompted as Byer looked at the world's most expensive champagne with new respect. He had to admit, he was charmed by the twit's nautical touch.
This predicament is intolerable to you, but also to me. To fully enjoy my assets, I need the world back the way it was, said Sir Eric. I have identified some impediments to this goal. Chief among them is the Tiangong station orbiting above the Pacific, and what it does to limit your ability to act in the manner that I need you to act. It allows the Directorate to effectively command the heights of any battle. And as best as I have been able to determine from my extensive contacts, you have failed in all your attempts to attack it. This, you worry, ultimately leaves you only the option of a nuclear response, which you are not certain would succeed, and which, more pertinently, would escalate this conflict in a matter that would truly make all our lives intolerable.
I cannot confirm or deny any of that, but for the purposes of our conversation, let's assume you are correct, said Byer. He felt the champagne flute warming. From 1907, it would be a shame to waste it. From the heavens come... Oh, forget all that, said Cavendish, his cultivated accent slipping back into his native Australian one. Look, mate, if you want to win back your waters, and I do believe they are providentially yours, you are going to have to do something about that damn space station, but without provoking a nuclear fuss, righto? Byer nodded. It was now or never with the champagne. He drank it down in one gulp. Well done, Cavendish, his British accent returning. In exchange for a letter of marque, sicut aliter scitur, my hunting license, I will eliminate this impediment to your operations at a time of your government's choosing. How might this work? Said Ford. First, the contract part. My lawyers advise me that, as allowed under Article 1, Section 8 of that fantastic old document, the United States Constitution, I will require a letter of marque in order to be registered as an official privateer, said Cavendish. You know, perhaps I might be able to acquire one of the original copies of the Constitution. What would that run, Miss Ford? Safekeeping and all that. Byer interrupted. The champagne had been pretty decent, but the little twit was back to wasting his time. Look, I don't care what the lawyers think, not my job. What I care about is winning this war, said Byer, because I'm not here just to help you cross an item off your bucket list. No, Admiral, I am here to help you, said Cavendish. How? Said Byer. All I see is a guy with a funny name who's sitting in a plane rigged out like a porno set and drinking a glass of old champagne in a country that's trying to explain to kindergartners how rationing works. So what are you going to give us in exchange for this letter you want? A secret weapon, the likes of which the Directorate has never faced before, whispered Cavendish, softly touching his empty flute against his temple. My imagination. USS Zumwalt, Mare Island Naval Shipyard. Vern Lee wiped the sweat from her brow and looked again. There. She took off her viz glasses, and the graffiti was gone. She dabbed the sweat from her nose and put the glasses back on. There it was again. She wobbled as if the ship were pitching at sea. The fresh red paint looked like blood. We are watching you, chink. Vern, you okay? Asked Terry, a 35-year-old software engineer from Caltech, who was working with her in the confines of the engine room. I think so, said Vern. Sit down here, Terry gently commanded. Do you want a stim? We've been at this for, like, 24 hours. Do you see anything odd here at all? Said Vern. Yeah, everything I see on this ship is odd, said Terry. No, I mean, do you see anything around us, like writing on the wall over there? Said Vern. Writing? No. You want me to get the corpsman? Asked Terry. This is not good. How much did you take? It's not the stims, said Vern. I heard there was a bad batch going around. Might have been directorate tampering. At least, that's what the gov feed said. But the smart money says someone's cutting it with laundry soap to make a few extra bucks. Chink. What century was this? How dare they doubt her? Here, sit down, said Terry, more firmly this time. What's the matter? Vern opened her mouth to explain what she was seeing and then clenched her jaw shut. If the power systems failed in combat, the ship and likely whoever wrote that would die. And the power systems depended on the Chink's graduate school science project. It was that simple. She flung her viz glasses at the spot on the wall. They hit where the graffiti would have been if someone had the courage to write it in actual blood-red paint. Vern, said Terry, take it easy. I'm going to go get somebody. You just rest. Vern crawled on hands and knees to pick up her glasses. They weren't even scratched. How she wished they were broken.
She pushed the reset button at the temple and waited for them to reacquire the Zumwalt's network. She closed her eyes when she put them on. When she opened her eyes, the graffiti was still there. The sound of heavy footsteps made her get up. "Vern, this is Chief Simmons," said Terry.
"Dr. Lee, I hear you're not feeling well," said Simmons.
"I'm just tired of this shit," said Vern.
"From what I understand, you may be the most important person on this ship," said Simmons. "So you're part of the equipment, then, and that makes you my responsibility. Let's get you topside, give you some air, feed you, and get you back to work."
Vern laughed at the notion of her being literally a part of the ship. This world seemed so absurd because it was true.
"More important than the captain?" said Vern.
"Well, that's a complicated answer for me, Dr. Lee," Mike laughed. "I'll just say definitively, you're more important to the ship."
Vern laughed again. Terry gave them both a nervous grin. Vern studied the old sailor. It seemed he'd never had a day of doubt in his life.
"Terry, I need to have a word alone with the chief," said Vern.
Said Terry. "All right, I'll go grab some water and then meet you by the stern." Mike stepped aside to let Terry squeeze past. Despite his heavy footsteps, he had a surprising ease about him on the deck, at least for an old guy.
"So, Dr. Lee, tell me what's really going on," said Mike.
Vern took off her viz glasses and held them out.
"You have to see for yourself," said Vern.
"Why don't you just show me?" said Mike.
"I am," said Vern.
"No, I mean, actually show me," said Mike.
"I can't. You need to wear my viz," said Vern.
Simmons held the glasses out in front of him with a mix of disdain and, Vern sensed, fear.
"These won't fit," said Mike. "How about you tell me?"
Vern saw that uncertainty was a rare feeling for him, and that made him even more uncomfortable.
"You've never used viz before, have you?" she asked.
Mike looked down at the scuffed toes of his boots.
"No, I haven't," said Mike. "I never saw the point."
"I know you're an old fart, but you're not that old," said Vern.
Her face reddened with embarrassment, and anger flashed across Mike's features.
"I'm sorry. That's what they said we were to call you guys. Please, it's important," she said. "It's about the ship."
Before he could move, she placed the glasses carefully on his face. She noticed that his right ear was slightly lower than the left, and that his nose had been broken at least once. He stiffened and then relaxed once she backed away. He lost his balance, and she lunged forward to steady him with an awkward hug.
"Sweet Jesus," said Mike.
It was so real. He'd heard it was something about the way they projected a data stream onto your retinas that made it so different from the first generation Google Glass. With these, you weren't so much looking through the glass at the world. It was more like the world was being brought inside your brain. It gave you the sense of not just seeing, but feeling, and it felt damn weird. Vern led him by the hand to the graffiti. He saw the sticky red that part of his brain said was real, even down to its smell, and that drowned out the other part of his brain whispering that it wasn't real, that it hadn't been there just a few seconds ago.
"What the hell is that?" asked Mike. "Blood?"
"Yes, at least, it's supposed to look like blood," said Vern.
"Who did this, goddammit?" said Mike.
He squinted and slid the glasses down on his nose and then back up. Down, then up again.
"That's the sickest, most cowardly thing I've ever seen," said Mike. "Anyone else see this?"
She noticed his breathing had gotten deeper and the veins were bulging at his neck.
"I don't think so. Just my viz feed,"
said Vern, starting to collect herself.
"Don't worry about it. This bullshit, too, will pass."
Mike stepped back and looked her over.
"No, Dr. Lee, I have to do something about it. This bullshit doesn't happen on my ship," said Mike. "The captain has to be informed. The XO, too."
"Shit," said Vern. "What if they think I'm some kind of risk and make me leave? I had to get the FBI to watch my mom's house because of all the threats she got after I disappeared to come work here. People assumed I'd left for China."
Mike scuffed his boot along the deck and shook his head.
"Actually, Dr. Lee, as I understand it, you'd be the last person to leave the Z, no matter what the graffiti on those glasses says. Whether you like it or not, you are now part of this ship.
and let me be clear, I take care of my ship.
Directorate Command, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. The pistol's barrel was pointed right at Colonel Markov. This is the fourth time I've had to endure this performance, he thought. General Yu Shilai shook the weapon slightly, as if he could not understand why Markov hadn't grasped the gun in Fang's.
Did you know I found it with an empty magazine? Said the general. He fired his very last round right at me.
But how did you survive unscathed? Said Markov, taking the pistol, playing his role. The general sat on the edge of his desk and ran a hand over his freshly shaved scalp. He shifted his body before he began the story, the wooden desk groaning under his bulk. Yu looked the role of a warrior, an image that, like too many generals, he'd traded on for much of his career. He was built like an Olympic heavyweight wrestler, a shaved skull, deep-set eyes beneath a thick brow that presided over prominent cheekbones and a large, sharp nose. But long ago, Markov had learned not to confuse the look of a warrior with actual military ability.
Like all battle, a mix of skill and luck. This American Marine general was a warrior. Straight from the Viz. He knew he could not be taken alive. After all, he was in charge of their Pacific Command's most important base. When I entered the room, there was so much smoke, but I was ready, said General Yu. My pistol was drawn. Grenades! They shouted behind me. No, I shouted back, no.
And why not? Said Markov. Honor, said General Yu. He was a fellow warrior who deserved to die fighting.
It was so smoky. Sparks and a little fire over in the corner where one of those phosphorus grenades had already gone off. Theirs or ours, I don't know. It smelled of burning plastic. The incense of battle. Right, Colonel? I could barely see, but I could sense the danger.
He fired and I fired back.
How many times? Asked Markov on cue.
Just once, said General Yu.
One shot was all I needed.
He put his index finger between his eyes as if to make it clear he didn't miss.
General, I am impressed, said Colonel Markov.
He'd had his doubts after the first telling, but the story was actually true. Markov had checked with one of the commandos who'd been with General Yu that day. The weapon had indeed been pried from the dead hands of the Marine base commander, killed by the Directorate General himself. But that didn't earn him Markov's respect as a leader. He passed the Sig Sauer P226 pistol back to the general, who might have been good at leading a small unit of men in the heat of a gunfight, but who was out of his element in a war that no longer followed his rules. Markov had always thought Americans would make fierce insurgents. So strongly did they believe their national narrative. After the first suicide bomber, at the King's Village shopping plaza in Waikiki, Markov knew he was right. That's why Yu kept telling the damn stories about the opening assault on Honolulu over and over. It was the one day of this war that made sense to him.
Not a business. We have to deal with the problem at hand decisively, said General Yu.
Just like the general you shot, said Markov. Yu's fingers twitched and clutched the Sig pistol.
Exactly. At least he fought with honor. I've lost enough of my men. Every night I record a message for each one's parents or wife, or maybe a brother, whoever is left. They deserve to know their loved ones died doing something important. To hear it from me.
The general paused. Markov eyed the massive man, who seemed to grow just a little bit weak at the thought of his nightly ritual. He'd seen it before. Yu was taking the losses from the insurgency personally, a mistake too many tactical leaders made, missing their greater responsibilities. The huge officer gathered himself and slammed the pistol back on the shelf.
It's time to put a stop to it, to be relentless in our patrols, to follow them, where they hide, and exact a price for every man of mine they kill.
General, my value to you is in my candor, said Markov quietly. So let me say that this is all wrong. The people here control our fate. You do not control theirs. It is a lesson I learned the hard way from our own experiences with insurgency. Indeed, even the Americans learned it during their own last few wars.
Their lessons of failure are the least we should learn, said Yu. We don't need to make friends with them.
We need them to acquiesce, and that may require us to show more resolve.
And ever more bodies? Said Markov.
Shanghai is concerned about the optics of these attacks in the run-up to the trade conference with the ASEAN nations. They're sending a high-level delegation to visit the planned locations, said General Yu.
Locations? You mean here? A Presidium delegation is coming to Hawaii, asked Markov.
Yes, and the son of one of them has just chosen to go missing, said General Yu. The idiot's a Navy lieutenant. His father's the economics minister.
All the more reason not to take the insurgents' bait, said Markov. You don't need another car bomb or an arson spree right now. Not with the delegation coming. Don't provoke the insurgents.
Provoke? Said General Yu. You fail to grasp the new reality, just as the population fails to see theirs.
Let me deal with these criminals my way.
Colonel, your job now is to find this lieutenant, nothing more, nothing less.
Very well, sir, said Markov. As he left, he cast a look around the office, taking in the other vulgar trophies from the invasion. A scorched F-35 pilot's helmet sat on a shelf. The American flag that had flown at Camp H.M. Smith was folded in the glass case that also housed the pistol. A cracked gray Honolulu police SWAT team ceramic vest was affixed to the wall, next to a live tactical situation map of Directorate military patrols in the city. The general had gathered all the totems of his opening day victory, thought Markov, while failing to see he was on his way to losing a different kind of war. Pineapple Express Pizza, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. The first thing Major Conan Doyle noticed was the smell. Warm mozzarella, the sweet tang of tomato sauce, and the pungent funk of fresh Hawaiian marijuana. Her mouth watered, and she clenched her stomach muscles to check the pain in her gut. They entered through the alley off Ala Moana Boulevard and made their way down to the basement. By the time they reached the bottom step, the food aromas were gone.
Smells like shit in here, said Nix.
That the dope? Asked Finn.
Nope, said Conan. More likely us.
The restaurant's owner, Skip, came down a few minutes later with a boar sausage and pineapple pizza.
Can't persuade you to have a broccoli with signature sauce?
The last thing my team needs is to get stoned, said Conan.
There were literally 100 ways to mix marijuana into a pizza. Skip's specialty was infusing it into butter and olive oil, which kept the pungent taste from ruining the tart flavor of a fresh tomato sauce.
Your uniforms are all alike, always stressed out. Pills only, but you come back for the house special when the devils are gone, said Skip. Got any new footage?
Already left it at the dead drop, she said. You'll have to wait till you get back stateside to see it.
If that day ever comes.
It will, she assured him and herself.
He handed her a blister pack of red and black polka dot pills.
Ladybugs for dessert.
Thanks, brother, said Conan.
I have to head back.
I left Sharon up there, said Skip, and he waved a quick goodbye.
As Skip went back upstairs, Conan nodded at Nix and Finn.
You know what to do. I'll stand guard at the door.
She drew a stubby matte black Mossberg riot shotgun. Honolulu police issue, cracked open the storeroom door and poked it through. With her other hand, she picked up a slice of pizza. Nix and Finn moved aside some drums of flour and pulled up the grate on the basement floor that covered the sewage feed. They wrestled with the pipe's fitting, and then dropped a yellow-striped tube ringed with tracks into the pipe. The VersaTrax 300 had once been used by the Honolulu Sanitation Department for sewer pipe inspections, but the block of Nanoplex explosive duct tape to it now gave the sewer bot another capability. In military parlance, it was a VBIED, a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. Voices were raised upstairs, quiet footsteps followed, and Conan pulled back into the room.
Is it in? Whispered Conan. Someone else is here. Quit dicking around.
Bots in and inbound toward target, said Nix.
She sat cross-legged and could have been meditating, but for the viz glasses and control gloves she wore to guide the VersaTrax through the sewer system.
A girl's loud voice upstairs made them all wince. Skip's daughter yelling at some customer.
Just got red light from the command detonator, said Nix. Timer is set.
I don't like it, said Finn. We should hit him now. Take out a sector commander at least.
No. They've got dignitaries coming in from Shanghai, Seoul, and Tokyo, remember? Hit the targets from off-island, and we make sure the outside world knows we are still in the fight, said Nix.
Whatever, said Finn, pulling another slice of pizza from the plate.
Just get the little bot there first.
Roger that, said Nix. Her hands still guiding the bot from afar, waving in the air as if she were playing patty cake with an invisible child.
But first, I need you to feed me a slice.
What am I, your parent? Feed yourself, said Finn.
I can't. I take my hands off the controls and our little surprise goes up someone's toilet, said Nix. And I know I can't trust an animal like you not to eat it all before we get done.
They quieted at a girl's scream. Skip's daughter, but clearly scared this time. They looked to see what Conan's orders were.
Shit, said Finn. She's gone upstairs.
USS Zumwalt, Mare Island, Naval Shipyard. Laughter echoed through the corridor. It had not been a good day aboard the Zumwalt, so Mike saw no reason for this kind of screwing around. One of the fire suppression bots had detonated its retardant payload in the wardroom during the O200 meal. It looks like a herd of elephants had an orgy in there, a sailor had said, brushing past him. Then, there was the bigger problem this morning. The ship was supposed to be testing out the Navy's new Odyssey, Objective Data Integration System Enhanced program, a replacement for the pre-war Athena. But from what he could see, all the system had done was blow out a power coupling. The devastated look on his son's face had said it all. If the ship's captain couldn't contain his disappointment, then this setback meant something ominous. What were they thinking, naming a ship's control system after a story about a Greek guy lost at sea for 10 years? Nobody knew their history anymore, and apparently nobody knew network engineering either. Mike's bigger concern was the coupling. Spare parts were in short supply, and they couldn't just order another one from the Chinese manufacturer. In the corridor, Mike stepped out of sight and listened. He heard deep laughter, the kind that's amplified by a thick gut. A woman's voice, angry, followed.
You should be apologizing for much more than that, the woman shouted. If you don't attach this shielding here and here, then I'm going to be the least of your headaches.
It was Dr. Lee.
You need to understand that nothing you know about gunpowder or cannonballs or whatever you did a long time ago is relevant now, she said. If you don't shield the power cables, the energy they release, which is mostly...
Stop right there, lady, said one of the crew.
We get it. That's why we put some shielding there already.
If you want it changed, you put it in the work order system and we'll get to it. Your job ain't the only one that matters. Besides, who's going to verify your, work?
Verify my work? What's that supposed to mean? She asked.
Yeah, well, to make sure it's done right. That it can be trusted, you know? Or maybe you already got it checked out with Beijing.
More laughter.
This might not be good enough for you, but it's the goddamn best America can do right now. Next rail shipment isn't coming into Oakland until, next week, so as of now, it's good enough.
Mike couldn't place the voice. Whoever it was talked with a faint slur, as if he used a jawbone-implanted hearing device. Time to see who. Mike stepped around the corner and cleared his throat.
I'm hearing a lot of laughter today. Something funny? He said. Share with me. Not much makes me laugh lately.
No worries, Chief, said Parker, a petty officer second class in his 30s. We got this handled. We're just fixing some of the shielding on the ray gun.
Rail gun, said Vern.
Whatever you want to call this Star Wars shit, lady, said Parker.
My guide, the sailor. Parker was clearly taking advantage of the Navy's free hormone enhancement therapy. His skin was drawn and dry, but his neck and biceps were frighteningly thick, like a bodybuilder who was 5 months pregnant. Mike shook his head in disappointment. The mentor crew was supposed to guide the new generation of wartime sailors, but also to remediate new non-commissioned officers like Parker. The Stonefish strikes had cut down the ranks of the Navy's enlisted leaders,
and the wave of promotions to fill the gaps had elevated far too many men and women who are not up to snuff. Mike could see why Parker had topped out just below Mike's own old rank. Becoming a chief petty officer required more than just time and service. You also had to be able to make it past a selection board of your peers.
"Her name is Dr. Lee," said Mike to Parker. "You will address your betters by their titles."
He turned to Vern.
"You getting what you need, Dr. Lee?"
Mike said, drawing out the doctor. "We need more shielding on the power cables before we can run the live fire test," said Vern. Mike looked at her and then turned to Parker. He stepped up, so he was chest to chest with the sailor, unfazed by the younger man's bulk. As big as Parker was, he lacked Mike's ability to intimidate.
"Well, Parker here, he's concerned about America and her fleet," said Mike, speaking to Vern, but looking the sailor directly in the eye, daring him to disagree. "So seeing that you are a fellow American, hell, a civilian working her ass off to help arm said fleet, Parker just volunteered to weld it in for you, since working with metal seems to be something he's got a passion for," said Mike, a backhanded compliment for a sailor who spent too much time in the weight room. Vern pinched the bridge of her nose with obvious exasperation.
"You can't use metal welding. It is an electromagnetic gun. Needs to be welded with plastic, otherwise the electromagnetic energy will... You want to be the guy who blew up the ship because he didn't understand the future? Let's leave it at that."
All right," said Mike. "Parker, you have one job now. Find me more shielding and install it like she wants it. Just make sure you understand what she's talking about. If you have to strip apart your beloved weight room to get it, you will. If you have to use all the plastic chow trays in the shipyard, you will. Understood? If you need to bribe, screw, or steal to get what Dr. Lee needs, you will."
He turned to the others.
"I know I don't have to tell Parker here, but if anybody questions one of his fellow crew members' patriotism again, I'll grind you up and feed you to the seagulls myself. Now get back to it."
Pineapple Express Pizza, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. The Directorate Marine was twice the size of the pizza shop owner, and he was not holding back. A desperate gasp followed each blow as Skip's lungs emptied of air. The translator on the Marine's belt was oblivious to the violence, stating the order in a digital monotone. "Your daughter will come with us to a fancy party," said the device. Another Marine held Sharon. He pinned her arms behind her back, forcing her to stick her chest out. Her head hung down, so her black hair veiled her face.
"She's just 15, said Skip, gasping for breath. "She stays here."
Two more quick blows. The crack of Skip's ribs made Sharon scream again.
"Shut it," said the Marine in English, tugging hard on her arms.
Conan ducked back into the stairwell. A roundhouse kick from the giant Marine sent Skip sliding through a cloud of flour and down behind the counter. With his brow covered in white powder, he looked up at Conan peeking through the stairway door. "Help," Skip mouthed. It looked like he couldn't even get enough air in his lungs to speak. Conan squeezed the riot gun's pistol grip and ducked back out of sight. A burst of Chinese among the Marines followed. Conan closed her eyes. There were four Directorate Marines. She had 8 rounds of 10-gauge street shot loaded. She could blow apart the restaurant in a matter of seconds. Skip got up from his knees and charged the Marines. The wet sound of his head hitting the hard yellow tile made Conan's stomach turn. Enough. She raised the riot gun and flicked the safety off. She would have to get in close to make sure she didn't cut down everyone in the restaurant with the gun's wide arc of fire. She counted down. 3, 2, 1. Exhale. Go. And then she froze. This was not the mission. She clicked the safety back on. Skip tried to get up from the floor, but made it only to his hands and knees. He spat out a sticky crimson stream that mixed with the blood pooling from his split scalp. Then another kick landed with a thump on his temple.
Sharon wailed. Don't touch me!
Then muffled screams. Conan dashed back down the stairs silently on bare feet.
What the hell was going on up there? Asked Finn.
You're fine. I had you covered, said Conan. Just some customers getting rowdy. We gotta go out the back way, though.
Finn put his hand on Conan's arm.
What the hell is going on up there?
He asked again.
I said let's go, that's an order, snapped Conan.
Finn, Nix, and Conan filed out the back of the restaurant into the alley and slunk out in the darkness, slowly working their way toward their extraction point, an 8x6-foot steel recycling bin a few blocks away. They climbed in and covered themselves in the wet and moldy cardboard and aluminum cans that would break up their body's thermal signatures.
10 seconds to detonation, whispered Finn,
and he began to count it down.
And contact, he said.
Nothing. Well, at least the pizza was, said Nix. An explosion detonated in the distance, the blast wave shaking the recycling bin a bit. They waited the next hours for the morning pickup in silence, broken only by the occasional siren going by. It was just reaching early morning when Finn finally decided to bring it up again.
Conan, I'm serious,
Finn whispered.
What was all the noise upstairs about? Are Skip and Sharon okay? Yeah, they're fine,
Conan said quietly.
Let's stay focused on the mission.
Walmart headquarters, Bentonville, Arkansas. The act is so questionable in law as to make it positively un-American. Jake Colby's talking points had been produced by analytic software and then checked by legal and public relations. Both had advised Colby, the chief executive officer of Walmart, that the most effective approach was to flip the script and paint the White House's proposal to use the old Defense Production Act from 1950 as something out of the Directorate playbook. The act, passed at the start of the Korean War, gave the U.S. president the power to require any American company to sign any contract or fill any order deemed necessary for national defense. The CEO was now explaining to the shareholders that Walmart was joining a coalition of leading multinational firms that, using both the courts and congressional lobbying, would attempt to block the act's resurrection. Losing is un-American, a 70-year-old woman in a denim pantsuit shouted back at him. He knew not to ignore her. Leanne Tilden was a multi-billionaire who owned 4% of his outstanding shares, and yet she still worked as a greeter at the Tulsa store. The CEO tried to repeat the talking point's core premise, that a corporation's status as a legally defined individual meant that the government couldn't tell it what to do, even in a time of war.
Legally defined individual, Tilden retorted. Mr. Colby, you know that's bunk, and you know that Sam would want to help the country any way he could.
Before he could reply, another voice broke in, a Swiss-German accent. One of the institutional investors, in this case, representing a sovereign wealth fund from Qatar, that had bought a 17% position when the share price collapsed after America lost Hawaii.
Madam, I appreciate this company's quaint practice of letting anyone speak at these forums, but you simply fail to understand the multinational nature of this enterprise now. The global shareholder base must come first. This concern is not in the business of any one nation's war. No matter where it is based, it is a global retail chain, definitively neutral in its activities and intent, he said. The desires of Uncle Sam, or whatever your outdated idea of a patriotic patriarch in a funny hat is, are now beside the point.
Hearing the crowd growl, Colby winced at the fund manager's gaffe. So typical, the internationals loved the company's returns, but didn't bother to understand its story. She meant Sam Walton, you moron. Hell, the company founder's desk was on display in the museum just down the road. The papers he'd been working on the day he died still on it, as if he had just stepped out for a coffee break.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's try to keep focused, the CEO interceded. This is not just about the U.S. government overstepping its powers, however limited those now may be. We're on the razor's edge. The Directorate has rigged our corporate network with enough tripwires and viruses that we might lose control of the company if they don't like the way I part my hair.
Then what do we have to lose? Said Leanne. I'm calling a vote.
There was no loss of life at Leanne's revolt, as it would become known nationwide once the viz of the meeting leaked out. But it was nonetheless momentous. The voting bloc of sovereign wealth funds proved unable to stop the small investor pool once it was mobilized, and by the end of the meeting, shareholders were no longer voting about whether to resist U.S. government rationing schemes. Instead, Walmart declared war on the directorate. The color drained from Colby's face as he stared out at the thousands of cheering people in the company auditorium. Two thoughts crossed his mind as the tunnel vision took over. The first was that he'd have a hard time finding another job after this debacle. And the second was that America now had a new kind of logistical backbone, the likes of which had never before been seen in war. USS Zumwalt, Mare Island, Naval Shipyard. Mike found Vern hunched over, running her hands along the thick fiber cabling that ran behind the bulkhead. The smell of ozone hung heavy in the air, a reminder of her insistence that they cut open the ship's bulkhead so she could get access to this very point. What exactly she was doing was beyond him, Mike knew, but he liked the change it brought on in her. She might have had a PhD, but it was clear to Mike that in her heart, she was a maker, a doer, like himself. She abruptly ordered the rest of the engineers out of the area to let her work on her own. "Mike, you teach her to talk like that?" said one of them on his way topside. She spent more time aboard than at the Shoreside Network data center, and, to the best of his knowledge, she had not left the shipyard in a week. She no longer talked about her life pre-Z. He knew the feeling, and how all-encompassing it could be. He set a bottle of cold water down next to her. She continued to look at the tablet on her lap without acknowledging his presence. He stood back and studied her as she craned her neck to look behind the bulkhead. He pulled out an LED light and knelt down next to her, his knees cracking.
"Let me help," he said, "a little light."